Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 20th of January. 2 weeks ago, our attention was quite naturally focused on the horrors that were taking place in Paris. In Nigeria, in the northeast town of Baga, a couple weeks ago, the Islamist militant group Boko Haram, over a five-day period, killed every man, woman, and child that it caught. Eyewitnesses say the roads were lined with corpses. Up to 2,000 people were killed. In the city of Maiduguri, 19 people were killed when a suicide vest attached to a 10-year-old girl exploded. Survivors said the civilian militia battled Boko Haram, and they were pretty successful before they were ordered to withdraw by government soldiers who wanted to call in airstrikes, but the airstrikes never came. Why is Nigeria's military so inept when Cameroon's forces score plenty of victories against Boko Haram? And who are the people who are a part of this organization? What is it that America could do to help support the Nigerian government? What about the response of the Nigerian government? How can the horrors stop? And should the world's attention be focused on this part of the world and these horrors in the same way that they are focused on what's taking place in European centers? This hour of the program, we're going to be speaking with Alexis Akewo. She's a freelance journalist who writes about Africa and in November did a very, very lengthy and extremely thorough and well-written piece in the New York Times Magazine that looked at what's going on in Nigeria. And she has, at some risk, this is not an easy reporting job, I'm sure. She's been reporting from central and northern Nigeria about sectarian violence. She is a freelance journalist who contributes to The New Yorker, The New York Times, Bloomberg, Business Week, and the Financial Times Weekend Magazine. She's been based in New York, Mexico, and Uganda, and she was a 2012 fellow of the Alicia Patterson Foundation reporting on gay rights in Africa. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we look at the history of Nigeria, the rise of Boko Haram, these horrible massacres that have taken place. You'll recall, if you'll recall any stories, the kidnapping of 300 schoolgirls in Nigeria, and a couple hundred are still being held captive. So we'll welcome your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Alexis is recently returned from Nigeria. She's visiting family in the States right now, and Alexis, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It must be so hard to report on all of these horrors. It is so hard to read about them, and they've gone on for so long.
It is. You know, it's difficult to write about people who are suffering so much and who are pleading for, you know, attention from their own government, from the international community, and the hopes that their situation will change. But unfortunately, this war has been going on for over 5 years now with not much change, not much improvement in the lives of northeastern Nigerians.
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult to write about a very bleak situation.
That it is very bleak. Give us a little better understanding of the history of Nigeria, and starting with the rise of Boko Haram. Who are they? Why did they form?
Well, Boko Haram formed around 2001. Under the guise of a very charismatic sort of firebrand preacher named Muhammad Yusuf. And this was a man who was preaching against the corruption of the Nigerian government. He was preaching for justice for ordinary poor Nigerians who were suffering from a lack of education, who were suffering because their leaders were unaccountable to them. They were corrupt. Northern Nigeria is particularly more underdeveloped than the rest of the country, has less infrastructure, worse education systems. And so, you know, his message really appealed to people because they were, you know, they thought it's true. You know, we're at a disadvantage because our government is neglecting this region and it's neglecting its people. And so he gained a lot of followers in those days. But after a couple of years, his group – clash with the Nigerian government. And after a brutal crackdown by the Nigerian government, the group began an insurgency. And at that point, they became extremely violent, attacking innocent civilians, attacking military bases, police officers, grabbing weapons, robbing banks, orchestrating jailbreaks, and rising to become what is now a very lethal group. And in the beginning, they said that their aim was to establish an Islamic state. They wanted part of Nigeria or all of Nigeria ruled by Islamic law. But now people don't know what they want because they've attacked more Muslims than Christians. They just sort of take enjoyment in killing and creating havoc. And while now they've created a territory that is considerable in size, people's support for the group is significantly less than it was many years ago because people are under attack by them. They're being kidnapped by them. It's a very brutal situation in northeastern Nigeria right now.
And tell us more about the story. Is the name of the town Baga?
Yes, it's a small fishing town named Baga, and it's on the shores of Lake Chad. And it's just a small town where people are fishermen and farmers. It has been attacked by Boko Haram before in 2012, but this was definitely the most devastating attack that Baga had experienced and probably the Northeast had experienced. Boko Haram came in, killed hundreds of people. It burned down homes, buildings, anything they could find. And in the days following that attack, it attacked up to 16 other villages and towns surrounding Baga. And that's where the number of possibly 2,000 people dead comes from.
And yet it was a story, maybe because it was timed with the terror attacks in Paris, that did not receive very much attention. You wonder if this story were front page again and again, as the schoolgirl's story eventually became big news, that maybe it would force some kind of action.
Yeah, I do wonder that because on the one hand, while I understand that because terrorist attacks in Nigeria have become such a daily part of life that it doesn't attract the same kind of news as a terrorist attack in France would because it's relatively rare in France, I do think that if more attention was paid to it, it perhaps would put more pressure on the Nigerian government and its allies to root out Boko Haram.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the government response to this. It would appear that it is incredibly inadequate. Why is that? Why wouldn't the Nigerian government realize the horrors that are taking place in Nigeria and do everything in their power to get rid of this group?
Well, I think for a number of reasons. For a long time, the Nigerian government, under its current leadership, has treated the insurgency as a problem of northern Muslim leaders. The north is primarily Muslim, and the president's administration is southern and Christian. And so he has treated it as a problem of that region. And that insurgency hasn't, as devastating as it is, it hasn't affected any key natural resources or anything that's sort of been vital to the Nigerian economy. So the government has been able to ignore it and to allow corruption to flourish because really you have Nigerian soldiers on the ground who are fighting and dying in this war against Boko Haram, but they're crippled by the fact that they don't have enough weapons, they don't have enough armor and protective clothing because funds are being looted from the national security budget, and this money is not going to these soldiers who should be having what they need to defeat Boko Haram. If they had, I mean, Boko Haram surely could have been defeated long ago, but it's a problem of, neglect, a problem of corruption, and a problem of an administration that has just been wholly indifferent on this of this crisis.
And so citizens have taken the matter into their own hands, and you write extensively in the New York Times piece about a gentleman named Kali who's leading a group of insurgents of their own who are trying to fight Boko Haram. Well, they started, I guess, with sticks and glass. Now they've found a few weapons, but it's a tough struggle for them. Are they effective, and who are they?
It is. So with the attack in Baga and other recent attacks, Boko Haram has been specifically looking for places where the civilians have risen up to defend their towns and their families and fight against Boko Haram. So on one hand, it's a really admirable movement. Nigerians are standing up and saying, okay, if the military can't protect us, we will take up arms and protect ourselves. But the problem is that Boko Haram is retaliating, and it's attacking these a lot of villages and towns where civilian militias have risen up. And so it's a really difficult situation. I mean, in Baga, you know, the civilian militia tried to fight against the terrorists, but they didn't have the capacity, and they had to drop their arms and run away along with everyone else. So people are rising up, but it's a dangerous situation for them to do so.
What about, I've been reading that neighboring countries like Cameroon have been much more effective in stopping Boko Haram from infiltrating their country. What have they done that Nigeria has not done?
Well, one thing is that countries like Cameroon and Chad have it a little bit easier in the sense that northern Nigeria is still the base of Boko Haram. And so while they do make cross-border attacks into these other countries, they haven't established the same presence that they have in Nigeria. So it's a little bit easier for them to combat the presence of the terrorists in their countries. And then, you know, at the same time, there just seems to be a greater will on the part of these governments to root out these terrorists. They're giving their armies the resources. They're establishing committed efforts to do it, something that Nigeria could learn from.
Mm-hmm. And what is the current status of the schoolgirls who were kidnapped, what was it, last spring, really, from Shabak?
Unfortunately, you know, about 57 girls have escaped on their own. But, you know, that still leaves over 200 girls who are still missing. The Nigerian government said last fall that it was trying to negotiate again with Boko Haram for the group to release the girls. However, that did not work out. And in fact, Boko Haram released a video saying that it had given the girls to its militants as, you know, basically forced brides, and which is something Boko Haram has done in the past with other girls it's kidnapped. So unfortunately, it's a really dark situation for these girls right now. We hope that some will escape, as they've been able to, but a mass rescue does not look likely.
Mm-hmm. And as we try to understand the attraction to these Islamic militant groups, ISIS, Al-Qaeda in Yemen, whatever the groups are, Boko Haram, they've been described as being groups that some young disaffected men might find appealing for whatever reason. Is that a fair description of who makes up their members, and what in the world would be appealing about this?
Yeah, it is a fair description because, I think when you have the combination of young men who are unemployed, who don't have really any real opportunities because Nigeria is a country based on patronage, and so if you don't have the right connections or you're not a product of a family that can give you, you know, access to resources, then, you know, you have a bleak future. You're not employed. You don't have education possibility. And so Boko Haram is a chance to acquire power that would otherwise not be available to you. And so you have a core group of people in Boko Haram who are very much devoted to an ideology that's extremist in nature and religious, but then you also just have various outliers of men who were capitalized on it for money or for the power or for whatever else that Boko Haram promises them if they participate and work with them, whether it's a bride or it's pay or it's whatever other criminal gains they can get. That's how Boko Haram's attracting its members.
And yet, in order to be a successful member, you have to carry out these atrocities.
Right. Right. So, I think in that sense, a comparison to ISIS is really worthy, because there is something to say about the fact that these men are attracted to this violence as a substitute for whatever failures they may have felt that their country has done to them. It's disturbing and it's hard to understand. But we do know that Boko Haram is appealing to some people, and that on the other hand, they're also forcibly kidnapping other people to be in their ranks.
And Alexis, what is the U.S. doing to help rid the country of Boko Haram? How are we helping?
Well, the U.S. Has provided millions of dollars in support, in law enforcement support, in training support. Right now, the relationship between Nigeria and the U.S. is not at its best. The U.S. was supposed to help Nigeria train a brand new military battalion that would be specifically designed to hunt Boko Haram, and Nigeria has stopped that training. And Nigeria has complained that the U.S. has not given it the equipment and all the intelligence that it needs. But the U.S. is in kind of a bind because the Nigerian military is just compromised at this point, and it can't give it all the intelligence and equipment it needs until it's reformed, until the Nigerian military is reformed. So they're kind of at a standstill right now. But the U.S. is technically Nigeria's most important partner in the war against Boko Haram right now.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Alexis Akewo. She's just returned to the States after lengthy reporting from Nigeria. She will go back to Nigeria, where she's done very important reporting. There aren't many people who have covered this whole issue in all its complexity as thoroughly as she has. She's been covering sectarian violence in central and northern Nigeria for quite some time. You may have seen her piece in November in the New York Times magazine. She also has written for The New Yorker about this issue and many other publications. She was a 2012 fellow of the International Reporting Project at the Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies. And we are welcoming phone calls for her. Here's how you reach this. Would you agree that this is an issue that needs more international press attention? I know there are all kinds of issues to be covering, but when you have this group being this vicious for so many years now, and just recently in January walking into Baga, this small town in northeastern Nigeria, and killing virtually everybody, up to 2,000 people killed in that area in a period of 5 days. They've kidnapped schoolgirls, they've killed teachers, and they kill completely innocent people, and it's been going on for a long time with very ineffective response from the Nigerian government. So what is to be done? Questions you have about Boko Haram or Nigeria or Islamic militancy and what is attractive about this group, we certainly welcome your calls. Did I give you the number? It's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, we're going to be speaking with Amy Davidson, who wrote an interesting piece for The New Yorker on Germany's strange new right-wing meeting, Charlie Hebdo. Demonstrations, large demonstrations, met by counter-demonstrations of equal size in Germany in the last couple of weeks, but we'll look at the strength of the right in Germany. And we continue now. We have many phone calls for our guest this hour, Alexis Akewo, who is a freelance journalist writing about Nigeria's political situation and their militant Islamist group Boko Haram for The New York Times and The New Yorker. And we are going to go to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. And Victor in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Victor.
Hello, Kathleen. Hello.
Hi
to your guest. I was listening to a BBC interview last night concerning there was dismissal, I think, of 200-plus army personnel from the Nigerian army. And one of the complaints from one of the sergeants mentioned that they were ill-equipped to go against Boko Haram. I was wondering what led to those dismissals. Was it incompetency, or did the government clean house? My second question is, if and when there's elections, I'm assuming that the people in Nigeria, they have no faith in their government. I'm pretty sure it's going to be some tough elections for the president's political party because of their failure to protect its citizens.
Alexis.
Yes. Well, on the first question you have, I haven't heard about those 200 soldiers being dismissed. But in not too long ago, a couple of soldiers were dismissed, and actually some were sentenced to death for launching mutiny because they were so upset that some of their fellow soldiers had been killed in a Boko Haram ambush, and they were upset that they didn't have the guns and the weapons they needed. So there have been a couple of cases like that recently where soldiers have been prosecuted for protesting because they don't have what they need to fight Boko Haram, and it's a sad situation. On the second question, yeah, I mean, I think that these elections coming up will be the closest Nigeria has had in a long time. A lot of people are fed up with President Jonathan. They think that he's completely been incompetent and a failure as far as promising what he pledged to do, which was to improve the security situation and make Nigeria safe for its inhabitants. And so while his opponent is perhaps not the ideal candidate, he's a former military dictator, he does represent perhaps a new way of doing things. And I think this will be an extremely close election.
Has the southern part of Nigeria seen any of the same kind of violence the north has?
Not at all. It's experienced its own kind of violence. And in the Niger Delta region, when oil militants were doing violence several years ago, but nothing related to Islamist terrorism.
And the part of the country, you mentioned wealth, I think, earlier on, that the economy still seems to be strong, at least part of the country. Give us a little bit of history here, when the country got independence and how it would appear to have been, you write, pretty wealthy back in the 60s and 70s because of their oil-driven economic expansion.
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing about Nigeria. It has an extreme amount of oil wealth. And so for decades, in the 60s, in the 70s, people were guaranteed a level of prosperity. You could go to school. You can know that once you finish school, there will be jobs waiting. But that's eroded over time simply because Nigeria has not diversified its economy. And so you have a tiny elite profiting from this oil wealth. And what's interesting now is that because our oil prices have dropped so much, you know, up to by half, Nigeria is really in a predicament because on one hand it's facing this Islamist insurgency and on the other hand it's in a bit of economic crisis and it really needs to figure out how it's going to progress in the future. Before it could sort of ignore the insurgency and say, okay, well, at least we have our oil wealth and that's not being affected by the terrorists. But now that oil prices are going down, it has to confront both of these problems if it wants to continue to be Africa's largest economy.
Thanks, Victor, for your call. Ed in Bayfield, hi.
Hey, hi. Great program. Alexis obviously has a great insight. I spent a significant amount of time in Nigeria in the 80s and early 90s in the telecom industry, and I helped put in some of the total infrastructure there, again, a lot of time on the ground. And, you know, with all due respect to Nigeria and the people whom I love, it can be a real contentious situation there because of the former Biafran battles, and the people are pretty tough. They're stronger and more aggressive, if you will, and I don't mean that in a negative way, than a lot of other people that I've worked with through the years. As Alexis kind of mentioned, the corruption level there is breathtaking. It's heartbreaking. It's hard to comprehend. And I was there when Shehu Shagari was elected and the Naira was changed and foreign corrupt practices came in. So I've got a pretty good sense of the situation, and Alexis certainly has a more current sense. I think my point is that the American government, and again, I'm not picking on our country, but the governments of the West, those that pretend or wish to help, have got to recognize this and work with it in a slightly more pragmatic, if I can say, non-diplomatic way than we currently do. And I recognize how difficult that is because we've got to balance so many things, keeping the people on our side, again, diplomacy, keeping channels open for business and the oil and all of this stuff. But it's very, very complex. I think you need what we called old African hands on the ground working with or for the U.S. government to help deal with a heartbreaking situation.
And Ed,
Alexis is right. Good luck, Jonathan.
And Ed, when you talk about the corruption, what kind of corruption that was breathtaking, what did you see?
Everything from the street in order to purchase something or get a negotiate a taxi ride or get a meal in a restaurant, all the way up to, the central bank and the officials getting letters of credit, proper contracts opened and executed. So everything from the top to the bottom or the bottom to the top.
Right. Alexis.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, that's at the root of this insurgency. That's what brought about Boko Haram, and that's what's keeping Nigeria from defeating Boko Haram. The fact that Nigeria this war could have ended long ago, but it's corruption, unfortunately, that is keeping Nigeria stuck where it is, and it's what's keeping the U.S. from giving Nigeria, the help it could use, perhaps.
Could you talk, because it was so big a focus of an interesting part of your New York Times piece, talk more about this civilian GTF and this gentleman named Kali, who's experienced so much tragedy in his own life. He's leading this group because of the government's ineffectiveness in fighting Boko Haram. What is this group?
Yeah, the civilian GTF is a 1,000-strong vigilante group, basically. It's men who said in 2012 that, we're sick of this war that's killed our brothers, our mothers, our sisters, and we're going to do anything we can. So at first it started kind of as like a neighborhood watch. Men would, or really all people, would let the leaders of this vigilante group know, hey, I think this person's Boko Haram. Come talk to them and apprehend them and interrogate them. And so basically, this group was doing what the military was not able to do. The military had not been able to win the hearts and the minds of northeastern Nigerians and get them to give them the local intelligence that they would need to root out Boko Haram members who are living among, the local populace. So people began doing it themselves. And, they would apprehend people that they believed to be Boko Haram. They would, during attacks in villages, they would go out and they would fight with these rudimentary guns. And for a while, they really kept the peace in a couple of places in the Northeast. And to the point that the state government, one of the state governments in the Northeast, co-opted this vigilante group and got it working with the military so it could help them arrest and fight these Boko Haram members. So they've done a lot of good work, but it's a dangerous situation for them. Even when the girls were kidnapped, these guys, along with everyday residents, went out into Simbisa Forest, which is a big territory in the Northeast where Boko Haram is believed to have a lot of camps. And they went in and they looked for the girls themselves because the military wasn't showing up. Mm. So they've served as a substitute military and police for these people in the Northeast. And I think people were thankful for it.
And are they above board? You hint that some people have said they're
not. Well,
that's
the problem. As with any kind of situation where people take power into their own hands, there's the risk of abuses. And, there has been incidents where the group has used children under 18, you know, where they force people to join the vigilante group, you know, where perhaps they've arrested people who weren't Boko Haram, but who but they may have beat them or killed them anyway. So it's been a mixed bag, but it's hard to deny that they've helped the effort overall.
Ed, thanks so much for your call. Our phone number, our lines have been busy, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Alexis Okewo is our guest. She is just back in the States visiting family after lengthy reporting from Nigeria, where she will return. She wrote, you may have seen the article, if not, it'll be on our Facebook page. It's well worth a read. It's a very lengthy article about what's going on in Nigeria, the lack of effectiveness on the part of the government in fighting this horrendously violent group, Boko Haram, and vigilante groups that have formed as a result of the government not being able to take on Boko Haram. In the meantime, the violence, the horrors continue, with as many as 2,000 people just the week before last being killed in a five-day period of time. 800-486-8655. Ed, thanks for calling. Nice to hear from somebody who was on the ground in Nigeria. Ray in Milwaukee is next. Hello.
Let me use Martin Luther King as our guiding light for what I'm about to say. We have been funding these militaries, whether it's in the Middle East, in Africa, wherever it is, we fund these militaries, and it all comes back. You know, it's like the drones coming home to roost. Now, the guest just used the word, let's hunt these people down. Let's use Martin Luther King as our guiding light. No more money for any of the militaries over there. We could take half of the money we give to Egypt every year, and half of the money we give to Israel every year, and we could set up an African defense fund, which would provide humanitarian aid to all these poor people who are being slaughtered. We could set up refugee camps in nearby countries that they could flee to and take away the targets that these insane people are using to make us react, overreact, because we're about to give money. You know, the guest said, let's give money to their military, but they are so corrupt. Let's try nonviolence. What is wrong with nonviolence?
Alexis.
Of course, it's hard to disagree with the fact that giving money to a corrupt institution is not going to work. And I don't think the U.S. has been doing that. I mean, they specifically haven't been doing that. What they wanted to do was to train a whole new battalion that would be, you know, sort of relatively independent from the army and hopefully be more effective in fighting Boko Haram, but that didn't work out. The problem with nonviolence is that if you move all these Nigerians into camps over the borders, I mean, that's not going to stop Boko Haram. Boko Haram will then attack those camps. Boko Haram will then, you know, perhaps move further southward. I mean, at this point, nonviolence is not going to help. Nonviolence perhaps could have helped before the insurgency began, when Muhammad Yusuf was preaching and gathering followers and you know, gaining legitimate support for his ideas against corruption and maltreatment. But that time has passed, and you know, unfortunately, violence is what's going to work, but it has to be effectively deployed, and that's what's been the problem.
What about response from other neighboring or maybe not so neighboring African states? There must be deep concern about this organization, possibly, although it hasn't much yet spread beyond Nigeria, but the possibility of that happening and people just being sickened by the violence.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, There's been concern, of course, by its neighbors who have experienced Boko Haram's attacks, but there's sadly been a larger silence from, you know, for example, the African Union or neighbors around the continent, which is, you know, not out of tradition with the fact that Africa's leaders tend to let their other leaders get away with a lot. You know, if this had been a different situation, other African leaders would perhaps be criticizing President Jonathan and encouraging him to take more definitive action, but that hasn't really happened. We're hearing most of criticism and, you know, from Western countries, which is a shame. But at some point, there has to be a larger response, you know, from leaders in the region, even if it's just Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger, all working together to defeat this group.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ray, for your call. Tony in Egg Harbor. Hi.
Good afternoon, Alexis and Kathleen. A couple of weeks ago, Salman Rushdie was on Bill Maher's show, and he had made the comment that the different Islamic factions are really fighting one another, and it's Islam versus Islam and not Islam versus the non-Islamic world, and in his opinion, that this is a war that will never end. That being said, I think the trap that we in the Western world, at least in the United States, are getting into is we're starting to handicap this like we would football, baseball, or basketball, and there's so many different teams out there now, and we're quantifying, evaluating, measuring, describing, strategizing, and to us, this is a talking point for a talk show, but this is, no question, life or death for the people who are involved in it, and this is what we do.
I think that, sorry, you were asking that, you know, what is it that we do? I didn't get the
Tony,
last.
I didn't get it.
Yes. I guess as a country, we're looking at this as a, I don't want to equate it to a sporting event, but there's different teams now because there's ISIL, Boko Raton, and there's all the different, the Taliban, and it seems like we are starting to handicap Islamic Jihad in describing it in terms that we do professional sport, and it just seems to be awfully academic, and it's troubling to me that, you know, people are dying. And we're just quantifying this, and I'm not saying we can. It's a hopeless statement, I guess. But in the Western world, we're looking at this as in those terms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I agree that there seems to be a lack of humanization of what's happening in these places, and I think, you know, it's hard because it does seem so far away, and it seems, you know, these are crises on such a large scale, humanitarian crises, and I think that, you know, I mean, the U.S. is in a tough position because there's so many threats at once, and it's hard to know, especially when you're working with governments that aren't exactly cooperative, to know how to proceed in these situations. But I think with Nigeria, I think at this point, it has to be on the soldiers of Nigeria, and I don't think there's much the U.S. or anyone outside can do right now. I think that the impetus has to be on Nigeria to fight this war and to be more effective.
And he brings to mind, Tony does, this question, if there is an alliance between Boko Haram and ISIS or Al-Qaeda in Yemen, or is there any kind of collaborated sharing of intelligence or money for arms or anything like that?
Well, we don't have proof of real material support or connections, but we do, you know, we can see from their videos, you know, Boko Haram is using logos that are similar to ISIS. They're proclaiming their allegiance in their videos. They're copying their tactics. So we can see that, you know, there are these tentative links between these groups. And whether that is more, you know, we don't have proof of, but, you know, some analysts allege that Boko Haram has received funding and training from Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb. So, you know, there are these loose links that may grow stronger.
We'll take more phone calls for Alexis in just one moment. Alexis Akeo is our guest this hour. She is a freelance photographer who's been doing a lot of work for the New York Times and the New Yorker lately. She's based in Nigeria, and she's been writing about Boko Haram for a number of different publications. Last week, you may be familiar with this news. It was kind of overshadowed by terrorism in Paris, but Boko Haram reportedly killed up to 2,000 people in northeast Nigeria. They, earlier this year, kidnapped hundreds of schools from the government's secondary school in the town of Chibok, and it's not known where 50-some escaped, but there are still 200. Nobody really knows where they are at this point, and there have been just some horrendous killings of completely innocent people. So we're looking at why this group exists, what their goals are, and why the Nigerian government fails to be able to get them under control or get rid of them, and what the response or lack of response by the outside world has been. 800-486-8655 is our number. Tony, thank you for your call. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls for Alexis. Richard is calling in from Madison. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I have a question that's always bothered me. The economy of Nigeria is dependent on oil. I looked up in Wikipedia, and it's Mobil, Exxon, Chevron, the whole bit. How have they helped the Nigerian government?
Alexis.
How have they helped the Nigerian government?
How have they helped the Nigerian government?
I mean, to my knowledge, not at all. I mean, the thing is about oil companies in Nigeria, and I'm sure anywhere else, is that they're only concerned about what happens in Nigeria when it affects their interests. And so they're lucky because Nigeria's oil resources are in its south, in its deep south. And the only time those interests have been affected are, you know, as I mentioned, when there was a rebellion in the Niger Delta region several years ago, and people were rioting because their region was being polluted by oil companies, and they weren't profiting from the oil wealth. And so now the only time that the oil companies will complain is, you know, because of oil theft. But as far as the Boko Haram security crisis, you know, they've had no reason to really complain because it hasn't affected their interests at all.
We go to George and Galena. Hi. George.
Alexis, I'm curious. I know that the new emir of Kano has really condemned Boko Haram. That's a very powerful position in northern Nigeria. I served in Kaduna in the Peace Corps during the 60s. I'm wondering if you've spoken to him or if you have any thoughts about what might be happening there.
I haven't spoken to him, but I do think he's a really interesting figure. You know, this is a man who was the former governor of the central bank, and, you know, someone who some believe to have stood up against corruption in the Nigerian government. And now with this position as emir, you know, he has stood up against Boko Haram, and he's encouraged Nigerians to protect themselves going along with this sort of vigilante movement. And I do think, you know, that what he says is powerful. I think that it can affect the way Nigerians think about Boko Haram and, you know, whether they choose to support it or not. And so I hope he continues to use his position to speak out about it. You know, because other Muslim leaders have, you know, to varying effects. Some have been assassinated and some are silent now and don't speak because they're afraid of retaliation by Boko Haram. So I'm glad that, you know, the emir of Kano is saying something against this group.
And, George, your sense of what Nigeria was when you were there, was it flourishing?
Well, no. I was there during the original coups and then during the Nigerian Civil War.
Oh.
And it was a very violent time. And some of the problems that surfaced then, I think, are resurfacing now. The South is very industrialized, has many more Western connections, good or bad. And the North was very agricultural and certainly not nearly as prosperous.
Mm-hmm. Right. You must find this news, as somebody who's been there and served there, particularly troubling. Not that we all don't, but you have a different sense of it, George.
Well, certainly. I had great hopes for Nigeria when I left the country in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it collapse. Good luck, Jonathan, has not given good luck to the country. The corruption there is just overwhelming now.
Thank you, George, for your call. Tom in Sussex, hi.
Hi. Thanks for covering this important story. My question has to do with how are these people being armed? I mean, how are these weapons getting to them? I assume there are container ships leaving the U.S. and Europe that are feeding these groups. And why is this happening?
Well, I mean, to be honest, and it's kind of embarrassing, but Boko Haram has been able to arm itself largely through the Nigerian military. It's attacked when it attacks police stations, it attacks army bases, Air Force bases. It's able to steal weapons and to arm itself. Indirectly through perhaps Nigeria's partners, it has been able to get a lot of its weapons through the military. And, you know, also weapons, of course, coming after from Libya after the fall of Gaddafi. Mm. There's proof there of weapons trickling in from there. So, and it's a shame because at this point, Boko Haram appears to be better armed than the Nigerian military.
Really? Well, that's quite a statement. Are you going to return to Nigeria?
Yes.
And what stories, well, you don't know from day to day what stories are ahead for you, but some of these stories I would imagine are almost impossible to completely cover when you look at what happened in Baga because you couldn't get access to the town after this horrible massacre.
Right. Well, I mean, the next story that we're all sort of looking next to is the election next month.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unfortunately, it is a precarious situation because we don't know what Boko Haram will do to disrupt the elections. But on the other hand, it could be a potentially hopeful time if Nigeria elects, if Nigerians can vote and elect someone they believe will represent the country better and someone who can lead the country in a new way, if they believe that's Jonathan or if they go with the opponent.
And do you think there is that kind of belief in the opponent for a better way?
I do. I think there's a lot of uncertainty, but I think that there's a belief that, you know, let's at least try him. You know, if for anything, the opponent is known for not having engaged in corruption when he was the head of the government, which is promising. And, you know, there's some hope that, you know, we don't know what he'll do, but at least it could be better than what's been happening the last couple of years.
The bar sounds like it could be low, though. I'm not corrupt. Please vote for me.
Right.
Thank you so much for being with us and for your very fine reporting, Alexis. Thanks.
Thanks so much for having me.
Our guest this hour, Alexis Okewo, she's a freelance journalist. She is based in Nigeria and will be returning, as you heard her say, to cover the elections. She's been covering Boko Haram, and we draw your attention to the New York Times magazine section in November, which will be on our Facebook page, which was very well written and very thorough, looking not only at the history, but looking at the country, looking at the rise of Boko Haram and the vigilante groups formed in opposition to them and the complete failure of the government to stop the horrible, horrible violence and massacres of this militant group. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio in just one moment, and we'll return and talk about anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant demonstrations, some of which have been very large in Germany, and they're spreading to other European countries. Our guest writes for The New Yorker, so we'll talk about that hour two of this Tuesday show.